listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, September 18th, 2024. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunnath Cheesh, Hawa, Toyoksuk Nusum, Salamat for joining the conversation. On today's show, we talk with musician Nico Fuentes. He is in Juneau for a concert at the Filipino Community Hall to help raise money for a church in the Philippines. We preview tomorrow's SHI lecture, Tsimshian Art, with artist David Boxley. And we meet some of this year's Jesuit Volunteer Corps. The organization is celebrating 50 years of placing volunteers in Juneau. Those conversations, plus Tongass voices and more, coming up this hour on Juneau Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kushtak'u Bill Fawcett. And the word this week is yeh.
Yeh.
That means raven. And here's a sentence.
Yeh. Nitrianakut.
Raven is walking along the beach. Let's hear it again.
Yeh.
Raven. Gunnath Cheesh to Chune Lance Twitchell, Goldbelt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kushtak o Ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Occoquan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Now that will wake you up on a Wednesday. You're listening to Community Support at Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That was Nico Fuentes. And this Saturday, September 21st at 5 p.m. at the Filipino Community Hall, he will be featured in what's called a Concert for a Cause. It's all to help support the construction of a church in the Philippines. Salamat, thank you so much for being here, Nico. Really appreciate you coming in.
You're very welcome, sir. It is my honor to be here tonight. Today.
Yeah, today, right?
It's
dark
in here, so.
It's dark outside almost, too. And can you introduce your friend that you brought along with you today?
Yes, sir. I am with the guy in charge of this organization, Father Jose, or Joe Esteloso, from Aklan. He is the parish priest of that place, and of Madalaga Clan. So we are here to do this show for that cause. And here is Father Esteloso with me, beside me.
Thank you, Nico.
Hi, Father. Thank How are you today?
I'm good.
Awesome. And welcome. Is this your first time to Juno?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. And when did you get here?
When I arrived here last September 16.
Oh, okay. Okay. So just a couple weeks ago.
Two days ago.
Yeah. I'm ahead.
My wife, Linda, got in 3 days ahead of time. Okay. I am his advance party.
You scoped it out, figured out where the good food is.
Sir, the thing is, I am here ahead of time because he's monitoring the weather. How is it? Is it cold? What will I bring? What clothes will I bring? So that's why we have to communicate. Good thing with this modern communication, we can talk minutes. It's just in the Philippines, so
yeah. And as our weather is changing, it's definitely time to bring your raincoat, right? Yeah. I mean, he's definitely said bring the raincoat, bring the stuff that you need for that. So that's good. Well, okay, let's go back a little bit first, Nico. Let's talk about you as a musician.
Yes, sir.
And how you got started. Can you tell us about how you got started as a musician?
Yes, sir. It's a long way. Way back, I started my music career way back in the Philippines, 1975. I was first a folk singer, that's what they call down there in the Philippines, but we sing songs like James Taylor and all these things. And then I went to Japan. I was a diplomat down there. But those days, I have to raise a family, and my love is music. So I was a diplomat in the morning, and I sing at night in Tokyo Hilton.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and then I Japan days, my diplomatic days were gone. Somebody invited me here in California. He was the musical director for Sergio Mendez and the group of Tony Orlando and Don.
Oh, wow.
So I started, and me to be invited, it was a big thing for me. So when I got in, I was so disappointed because I became a driver and a roadie for Tony Orlando. And they did not know that I can sing. But this guy, the musical director, every time he does set up the stage, and every time they're finished, he asks me to sing for the sound check.
Oh,
so the band knows that I can sing. There was a time, one day, a blessing down in Anaheim, Disneyland. Tony cannot come in on time. So he asked the musical director, open the show on time, 7 p.m. So then get Nico, because I was a roadie. I was sweating. He said, suit up. I said, what will I do? He said, sing. So he goes like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tony Orlando show to open tonight. It's Nico. Here go. Only you. And everybody was clapping their hands. The second song, I was starting, and I didn't know that Tony was already standing on the side, Tony Orlando. So he got like, he asked me when I look at him, I have to give him the microphone. He said, no. Go ahead, just continue. So that started my career here in the United States. Then eventually, I was invited to sing in Las Vegas. And then I went all over the world just to sing with those group, the big group like Sergio Mendez, Tony Orlando, Andy Williams, all these people. Never been known in the Philippines as Nico Fuentes. Nobody knows me as a singer because I was doing backup singing for those big names.
Oh, wow.
And in the early 90s, I was given a chance to become a solo singer. And then I performed with the Filipino singers already, like big names, like Pilita Corrales, all these people here, all those so-called legends of the Philippines. But I am with them here in the United States. So every time I go back home, those days I only go back home once every 2 years, they invite me in their shows.
Oh, that's nice.
But still nobody knows me except my mom. And eventually, 1995, there was a comedian group in the Philippines. They're a rising comedian group. And they asked me to produce them all over the United States and Canada. I did. Then one of them cannot make it, so I became one. That's the group Pork Chop Duo. And I became the Porky of the Pork Chop Duo. I said, thank you, I don't have to go on diet to be called Porky. So that started my career for the Filipino community here in the United States and Canada.
Wow.
But this is my very first time to do it here in your place, Alaska.
Oh, well, welcome to Alaska. It's a pleasure to
have
you here. So I know that was what we heard was, of course, the famous Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison.
Roy Orbison.
And so what kind of music do you enjoy singing? Is there a variety of songs that you play?
It's a variety. I am a balladeer by naturally. I am a balladeer, but I only sing cover songs, like songs of the Platters, the Motown. Everybody, when I started this music here in States, I was auditioning with a Filipino group. They want me to sing good new songs, and I said, no, I only sing oldies but the goodies.
You like that early rock and roll period,
yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. And they go like, you can. So I wasn't able to go into Filipino group. But when I recorded these songs and I became a recording artist in Las Vegas, the Filipino is appreciating it already. So I kept on singing all those oldies but the goodies.
I love it. Okay. So let's talk about this event on Saturday. Again, it's Saturday, September 21st at 5 p.m. It's at the Filipino Community Hall, a concert for a cause. How did you get invited to come to Alaska? Did somebody from the Filipino Hall or from an organization know you in terms of like, and we're raising, this is a concert for, to raise money to build a church in the Philippines. So tell me a little bit about how this came about.
You want to know the whole story?
I want to know a little. Yeah, tell me.
The whole story is very funny because as you can tell that Gino is a big group of Filipino people, especially the family Carrillo.
Yeah.
The Carrillo family and our best friends of my wife, Linda Kimpo, and they were playing mahjong. Are you familiar with mahjong?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir. And Father Joe just visited me because we're talking about this fundraising thing.
Uh-huh.
And he wants me to help. I go like, if we're going to do it here in the Philippines, most likely, you know, what peso and dollars is. And I saw the Carrillos, they were playing mahjong with my wife. I said, why not we do it in Juneau, Alaska? Uh-huh. And that started. It was Linda Carrillo Taylor who really initiated this. And then here comes Novi. I think, you know, Novi, your friend, Novi, really pushed this up. And I'd like to thank her, by the way, Novi and Brian Duncan, to be here today with you.
I love it.
Without them, I don't think so. I can really reach this point, the hype of the Juneau concert, should I say.
I love that.
And by the way, sir, this is my first concert after four and a half years.
Oh.
Because of COVID.
Right.
The last concert I had was in Sweden. I was with the group ABBA.
Oh, wow.
I was the supporting cast for the group ABBA for the International Food Festival outside the park of Stockholm, Sweden. And then after that, COVID came.
Yeah.
So I was so silent. They asked me to do concerts on Zoom. It's totally different.
That'd be a lot harder.
And
yeah.
This will be my very first time. So I am back to so-called the greenhorn of shows again. So thank you very much, Alaska, for giving me a chance to prove to myself, even though I'm fading, now I'm sort of shining again.
I love it. So let's turn to you, Father. So let's talk a little bit about, this is a fundraiser for the construction of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Mission Station, Timbabon, yeah. So tell me a little bit about that and what you're trying to accomplish down there in the Philippines.
Okay. 2 years ago, I was assigned as a mission priest in that area, in Timbabon area, a mountainous part of Madalag, Aklan. It's a town of Madalag, province of Aklan in the Philippines. And when I came to that place, I stayed and I say masses in a dilapidated chapel. And that mission station composed of 8 barangays. So we decided to build a new church, and we come up with a devotion, Sacred Heart of Jesus. So we planned for the fundraising activities like solicitation, and like Nico said, that we came up with a plan to do, with Nico's help to do fundraising like this
in the
United States.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Here we are. So you basically inherited sort of dilapidated sort of a building.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to redo that rebuild it.
We will build a new one.
Build a new one. Yeah. Okay, so you're building a
Since
new one.
Since this is a mission station, and eventually it will become a parish.
Okay.
A parish. So we need a new church for a parish status of the place.
Yeah. And how much is this going to cost, if I can ask?
It's 24 million pesos, equivalent to $500,000.
Yeah, almost million dollars.
So about 500,000 US dollars or 24 million pesos. Okay. And tell me again where it's located.
In Barangay Alaminos, Madalag, town of Madalag, in province of Baclan, in the Philippines.
In the Philippines, okay. Yeah. And you've been, how long have you been a priest?
Since 2011.
Okay.
So this coming October 3, I will be, this is my 13th year anniversary.
Yeah. And so how did you come to becoming a father? How did that happen?
Since I was a child, I dreamed to become a priest, but since my family cannot support me financially to send me to seminary, so I look for some people to help me to finish my education in college, until college.
Yeah.
Because I need to help my brothers and sisters, because if I get to the seminary during the time, I cannot help my family, since
right.
I am the eldest. So I decided to take a 4-year course in college, and after that, I graduated in 1992, BS specialist, and I worked for 7 years, and I entered seminary in 1999. So in 1999, I was ordained in 2011, so almost 12 years in the seminary, formation in the seminary.
I love that. And you, Nico, you mentioned that you had been talking about this. So you two knew each other? How did you know each other?
Yes, sir. I did. We both did, actually. It was Father who produced it way back 8 years ago, yeah. 7 years ago. A fundraising thing like this. After the typhoon, big typhoon in the Philippines, there were so many people from our province, Aklan, who were homeless. So we did this kind of concert, and we were able to build about 28 houses for that, just for one night concert. Then that put in the mind of Father Joe. He said, if we can build 28 houses, maybe we can build a church. So, and he approached me again. And he's been thanking me because I said yes, but actually I'd like to thank him. Because before he approached me, I was trying to hang my microphone and say no more. That, as you can see, after 5 years, sir, Boston, I don't feel like I have the spark again to do it. So this is my first time here in your city, Juno, to prove if I can do it or not.
Well, your spark in the studio here was awesome, and we loved hearing that song. It is called A Concert for a Cause featuring Nico Fuentes. It's this Saturday, September 21st at 5 p.m. It's going to be at the Filipino Community Hall. And for tickets, you can call Linda Carrillo Taylor at 907-947-7307 or Maiden Cristobal at 907-209-7379, and it's all to help the construction of the Sacred Heart of Jesus Mission Station Tibaban down in the Philippines. Father Joe, Nico, thank you so much for coming in today. Salamat po, and I really appreciate it, and really have some fun on Saturday. I think you're going to have a huge crowd.
Will you be there?
I have a play to do. I'm in a play, so I won't be able to be there, but I'm there in spirit. For sure.
Thank you very much.
It's a lovely facility. You'll have a great time, and I know that the community is going to come out and support you all. So best of luck in building the church, Father. And thanks, Nico, for coming in and singing today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure and my honor, sir.
I really appreciate it. Okay, up next, this week's Tongass Voices, perspectives from the homelands of the Akwan and beyond. Mitch Erie is a U.S. Forest Service firefighter based out of Wrangell, but he says the job takes him all over Alaska and the country. The Forest Service is recruiting more firefighters now. There are 17 open positions in Moose Pass and Anchorage in the Chugach National Forest and in Juneau in the Tongass National Forest. Applications are open through next Tuesday.
My name is Mitch Erie. I am currently based in Wrangell as the assistant module leader of the fire program. So this is my 8th year with the Forest Service. My first year working in Alaska, actually. I did my prior 7 years working in Idaho on the Sawtooth National Forest and on the Nez Perce Clearwater. Similar jobs as to what I've had now, mostly based on hand crews. And this year I wanted to try something new, so I went for it and moved up to Alaska, and I've been loving it so far. So the majority of the firefighting I do requires travel to either the interior of Alaska. I did an assignment up there at the start of the year on the Kuskokwim River, about 2.5 hour flight to the west of Anchorage. And then just this last week, I got back from another assignment, and we were working in Colorado and Idaho. I've had a lot of moments on some pretty hard hikes where you got 50, 60, 70 pounds of equipment and stuff on your back, where you're going up a mountain that seems to just never quite want to end, and it's just false ridge after false ridge, and you're kind of working your whole way up to, and next thing you know, you're sitting at the top with all your new best friends and laughing and smiling and looking out across the landscape, or some shifts that never quite seem to end, and the hours keep just plugging on away and away and away. And so I formed some really close bonds with people that I still talk to on an absolutely everyday basis. I would say for me personally, probably the best parts can also be some of the most challenging parts. Living a life on the road can be challenging. Obviously, you're away for long periods of time. You miss stuff. You miss birthdays. There's people that I haven't seen in a few years that I really love too, and it's just challenging with the scheduling. As much as I love spending time outdoors, after 2 weeks outside, you're pretty ready for a shower and a night in a bed. I know that I've definitely had some of the most awe-inspiring moments of my life in this job and without the opportunities that wildland firefighting has brought to me. I mean, just this summer, I went on a flight through the Alaska Range out to our work area on the Kuskokwim River. And I don't know if I ever would have done that in my life. And we had, I think, 8 of us smashed into this tiny little airplane. And every single person was glued onto the window like a little kid, just awestruck at what we were flying through. And it just opens a lot of opportunities that you never otherwise see in your life, I feel.
That was U.S. Forest Service firefighter Mitch Erie for this week's Tongass Voices. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
15 candidates, 3 propositions, and 2 recall petitions are on Juno's by-mail ballot this fall. Tune in to the League of Women Voters candidate forums, co-hosted by KTOO and the Juno Empire. Hear from candidates for Juno Assembly and Mayor on Tuesday, September 17th.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Tomorrow at noon at the Walter Soboleff Building, that's Thursday, September 19th. The SHI Fall Lecture Series continues with artist carver David Boxley. His title for the talk, Shimshian Art. I caught up with David earlier today before he was about to depart from Seattle to Juneau this afternoon. Toyeksik Noon, I really appreciate you taking the time out before you head up here to Juneau. Thanks so much for being on the call.
Well, thanks for the invite. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so you're going to be speaking tomorrow at the SHI Walter Soboleff Building. You'll be talking about Shimshian art, and you have a long history in this art form. And I wanted to just talk about the beginning. Like, how did it start for you? How did you discover it? And how has it become such a passion?
I've been an artist since third grade, pretty much. My journey into Native art sort of started in college. I minored in art in college, and then I started doing a series of oil paintings in my art classes of our people. I titled it As They Lived. I did couple dozen paintings of our people living, traveling, hunting, fishing, warring, canoes, you know, weapons, things like that. And just when I started carving, I gave up oil painting pretty much totally. I started doing native art, and I didn't start doing native art or our art until about 1979.
You and I share a bond in the sense that we were raised by our grandparents, and I'm wondering, like, what that influence, how that was an influence on you as a young boy.
My grandparents were the most important thing in my life, and in some ways still are, even though they've been gone for quite a while now. Their pictures are in my shop here, in my workshop, and I see them every day. I think about them pretty much every day, especially my grandfather. They took me out of the hospital when I was 2 days old, and essentially I became their fifth child. My mother wasn't around a lot, and I lived with them, and for the most of my young life until I went off to college. And then when I moved back to teach and coach in Metlakatla, I lived in their house with had a new wife at that time, and moved home and got married in my grandparents' house. And my grandmother passed away about 6 months after I moved home, and lived up there for another 6 years. And then I decided to, by that time, the art had and the culture, well, mostly the art had been taking a pretty prominent role in my life. And I was pretty busy. I had a full-time teaching job. I owned a business, an ice cream parlor, bakery. And I was also pretty much carving full-time. I don't know how you do all three things full-time, but I was. I decided to make a big change. I had two young children and a young family. And I decided to make a heartbreaking decision to leave my grandfather. He was alone at that time. My grandmother had passed, and I wanted to see what I could do. I wanted to move. We moved to Seattle, and so I could be near galleries and collectors and get my name out there. And it was the right time too. In the 90s, the early 90s, the economy was really good. I had opportunities come one after the other for large commissions and things like that. So it worked out real well. I don't know if I probably would not do that now. It's harder. It's really hard to make a living. It's hard to make a living as an artist. You've got to really be focused, and it doesn't matter what the genre is. You've really got to be focused and really be flexible and put out a lot of work and get your name out there. It's a very competitive world.
What have you seen in terms of shifts over the time that you've been an artist in the art world? Has there anything that's changed? Has it become like you? I mean, it's definitely more competitive, but are there other changes that you've seen over the last 30 to 40 years?
Well, the two main changes that I've seen are the first one, and it started a while back, about halfway through my time in Washington, was a lot of people come and go. And a lot of people jump into the art and it's a fad for them, or they get excited for a while and then they drop out. And there's so many now that I remember that we're trying to do things when I was first trying to get my name known, and they're not around anymore, or they haven't been for quite a while. And the other thing was that galleries have really changed their mode of operation. Most galleries, there's one left that still hangs on to carrying the work of non-native artists who are doing Northwest Native art. And that's been a big change. And then the amount of galleries has been reduced too. There were some galleries that I did a lot of work with early on that don't even exist anymore. But the third thing I just thought of, the third thing is that there's a lot more native artists now than there was when up and down the coast, British Columbia and Alaska and Washington, Oregon. There's a lot more quality native artists now, this new generation, my son and his generation, some pretty fabulous artists from all the different tribes. And that's a good thing too. When I first came down and was trying to break into the galleries and that, there was hardly any, especially from Alaska or There were some Canadian artists, but there were a lot of non-Native artists that were selling their work into galleries and into collections, things like that. But there's a lot more really good young men and women, Native women and men, who are, you can find their art in prominent galleries now.
I know you're a strong proponent of education. I know you've said that, you know, we're responsible for passing it on to the next generation. Can you attribute some of the proliferation of artists to folks like yourselves who are teaching the next generations?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a really true statement, because every tribe has somebody like me. You know, I'm not all by myself in that. I'm seeing Haida's, Tlingits, Kwakwaka, Salish people. They all have leaders or artists who are really, really good artists. And the ones that I have the most respect for, or look up to even in now, are the ones that are not only just artists, but they're the ones who plan potlatches or teach, take on apprentices, and hopefully trying to preserve their languages and things like that too. You know, there's an old saying that Native artists, coastal artists, are the canoes by which the culture travels. And it's just a metaphor about that knowledge. You know, it's more than just putting chips on the floor, you know, creating totem poles or canoes or masks or things like that, but passing on that knowledge and it's happening. It's happening all over. You look at the totem pole raising that was in Craig a couple days ago, this past weekend. Reg Davidson put up a totem pole that kind of united the Canadian and American Haidas. They had a potlatch. I was looking at that on online, and I happened to be in up there in that area not long ago, and I went and visited him in the workshop where they were doing that pole. And he must have had five people working on that pole with him, and he does that a lot. He has a pretty good crew, and when he needs the help. But yeah, passing it on helps it to live. That's an old tradition.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm talking with David Boxley, who's giving a talk on Tsimshian art tomorrow at the Sea Alaska Heritage Walter Soboleff building at noon. And, you know, you mentioned making a name for yourself, and I thought this was interesting because you have three significant Simialiak names, and I'm wondering if you could tell us about those and how you were given those names.
Well, actually, I have four, but the first one was just... my grandmother gave me a name when I was a baby. It's just kind of a combination of the word baby and the word David. And the only people that really call me that anymore are people that I grew up with back home. But I received my first important name in 1982 from Alfred Eaton, Eagle Lakskeak clan elder, at the first potlatch that I gave in Metlakatla. It was the first one in 100 years. The only and it's kind of got things started. I got that name, means first the potlatch. And in 1987, there was a 100th anniversary in the village. I did a totem pole honoring the elders in our village, and a big raising, and it was the beginning of the fourth generation dance group. I wrote songs for them and led them at the beginning until they established themselves, and they're still at it. And that name was given to me by my grandfather. It was his brother's name, Nukutsismask. It roughly means works with cedar bark. And then a couple of years ago at a naming potlatch in Metlakatla, the Eagle Clan surprised me with a new name, a song to go with it, and didn't know what was going to happen. We had just finished all of the all the other names, and kids got their new names, and it was a really good feast. And then they gave me the name Nisbupen, means grandfather of totem poles. It was because I had that time made 80 totem poles. Made a few more since then, but it was a very humbling experience, because the whole clan, or as many as that were there, came up to the front of the hall and stood behind me, and they gave me the names and sang the song. It was pretty significant.
Wow, that sounds... I love that it was a surprise, too, that you didn't know it was coming.
It's, you know, the good part, the best part about that, I think, for me, was that it's been a long struggle, you know, since the 80s, of reviving our culture and trying to convince our own people that that was a good way to go. You know, Christian influence and missionary influence in Metlakatla was really strong and still is in some ways, but things have changed a lot, and my son's generation are now that age group, are now the, especially with the dance groups, that's the main focus anyway. They've become the cultural leaders. One of my, I don't know what you could call it, happiness is that when I go home and there's an event, unless I'm in charge, like of an Eagle event or helping to make it happen, I don't have to do anything, you know, in terms of telling people what to do or leading anything, because so many people now know the rules of the potlatch and all of that, all of the things that you need to do. I don't have to. It makes me happy to know that it's so different now than it was when we first started.
I love that. I guess the name that means first to potlatch is actually significant here. That's really cool. So can you tell us a little bit about what we can expect tomorrow at the talk? The title is Tsimshian Art. I'm assuming you're going to go over some of the history and talk about what's going on with that. But what is the talk going to entail tomorrow at noon?
Yeah, it's a PowerPoint. My wife and I and a friend of ours, you might know Steve Quinn, He contributed some of the photos, but there's going to be a lot of photos. It's a really very personal view of my art journey. A lot of pictures of the art itself, passing on the knowledge to students, to my boys, my grandkids, my dance group. The focus of the talk is that the art is critical to all parts of our culture, our cultural journey, and it all comes from the potlatch, and how the potlatch is the hub of our cultural wheel, and everything else radiates out from that, the spokes of the wheel. I try to tie all that stuff together. That art is, you know, it wasn't just art in the old days too. It was ownership of rights and privileges and crests, and you know, it just permeates everything that the old folks did. But same way with us too: singing and dancing, carving, potlatch, and passing it on to the young ones.
Last question for you, David. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us before you travel up today. What is your hope for the future?
I'm really positively hopeful about the fact that there are young people who are real serious about preserving this, what is left of our culture. It's not even close to what it was, you know, in the 1800s, but it's come so very far along. And my village, even though it was founded on Christian principles and left all of that old stuff behind, especially for Tsimshian people, become a center for cultural preservation. My son and his girlfriend Candy and others who are trying to hold on to language and the knowledge of the potlatch, which is so important. It makes me feel good. There was a time when I thought, man, I feel all alone in doing this, but I haven't felt that way for a long time now.
That's artist David Boxley. He'll be part of the SHI Fall Lecture Series and will speak tomorrow at noon, September 19th, at the Walter Soboleff Building. The lecture is live and will also be archived on the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's YouTube page. You can find out more about David at davidboxley.com. And for more on the lecture series and upcoming speakers, visit SeaAlaskaHeritage.org. Up next, we'll meet the folks from the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. It's the organization's 50th year in Juneau. This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Jesuit Volunteer Corps Northwest is celebrating 50 years of placing volunteers for year-long terms at social service agencies in Juneau. Joining me now in studio to chat about that are Doug Kramer, as well as Executive Director Greg Carpinello. Welcome, Gwyneth Cheesh, for being here today. It's wonderful to have you in the studio. How are you? Wasa iati.
We're doing really well, David. We've enjoyed our trip and the great weather we had yesterday, so it's nice.
Nice. I'm Boston.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Who's David? I want to know who this David guy is.
I've got too many things on my brain.
You've got a lot of things going on.
Brain got back to soggy today, and I messed up my names.
It's the rain.
The rain makes our brains a little soggy for sure. I was thinking maybe David was one of the volunteers, because there's a whole group of new volunteers for this season, right?
That's correct. We have five new ones who just started in mid-August.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about who they are and where they're going to be.
Yeah, great question. So these five volunteers come from all over the place. We were just getting their bios right in our heads last night. And so many of them from the East Coast, but one from Idaho this year, one from Ohio. We have New Jersey. We have, who else did we have from
Ohio? You said Ohio.
Yeah. So they're coming from all over the place, and for many of them, this is their first time in Alaska.
I love that, and I know this. The sheet that you gave me here, are these quotes from them? Is that the people who are here?
Yeah.
So I just want to read some of these guys. I think they're cool. So Julia is here, and she says, "I want to contribute to a world that embodies kindness, humility, and builds connections rather than walls." Mm. I think that's lovely. Mitch says, "I serve because feeling others, being present for others, and being present fills me." Mm. As well as Aaron says, "I hope to share my gifts and abilities with a new community and learn new lessons along the way." Well, that's just three of the volunteers who are quoting why they're here and what they're doing. So let's go back a second, though. And Greg, can you tell us, what is the Jesuit Volunteer Corps Northwest?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's been almost in existence for 70 years, but it started here in Alaska in the mid-1950s. The Jesuit Catholic priests who were starting a school in Glen Allen, Alaska, started to recruit young people, typically fresh out of college, who wanted to do something meaningful with their lives, and brought them to the Copper Valley School and put them to work. And they did all kinds of things to make that school run. Eventually, that movement of recruiting volunteers to do good in Alaska spread to other places in the state, and then eventually over the coming decades throughout the lower 48 states and even internationally.
Oh, wow. That is very cool. Now, you said the organization's been 70 years, and I know in my intro I mentioned 50 years. So 50 years placing folks in Juneau specifically, but 70 years it was starting in Alaska.
That's right. So 1975 were the first volunteers that came to Juneau, and we've been here ever since.
Wow. And where are you based at, Greg?
So our main headquarters is in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, Portland. So by Northwest and saying Jesuit Volunteer Corps Northwest, where are you placing folks?
Yeah, so our organization places them in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana.
Okay. So, yeah, really the Northwest. Yeah. And where do you find the volunteers?
Well, you know, that's changing over the course of time, but we're still typically drawing from the population graduating from an undergraduate degree. About half of our volunteers come from Catholic universities or colleges, but we're finding more and more that we're finding volunteers from public schools, other Christian schools as well.
I see. Okay. Now, Doug, you have an interesting history because you were once a volunteer. Can you tell us about that story and how that brought you to Juno?
I can. So I spent 2 years as a Jesuit volunteer in the Northwest. I spent my first year down in Yakima, Washington, working with the migrant farm working population down there and enjoyed the experience so much that I was looking for a second year. And the people in the know definitely told me that coming to Juno was the best option for my second year. So, and we got a little bit of preference. So I took that opportunity and came up here. In about 94, 95, I was up here, and we lived over on Douglas Island. I worked for what was then an organization called Tongass Community Counseling Center, which no longer exists, but those programs still do through AWARE now, I think, and Gaston Human Services might have had them for a while. But I did that for a year working with men who had been convicted of domestic violence or other sorts of violent offenses.
I see. Okay. And I know you told me a little bit about Bud Carpinetti. Tell us a little bit about how you...
Well, like... A lot of people, Juno is still filled with people who came to Juno through JVC Northwest and have stayed here. I think our estimate is that as many as 50 or 75 people over those 50 years have chosen to make Juno their long-term home. And I didn't necessarily do that, but I came back a couple of times during summers. And then when I graduated law school, jumped at the opportunity to clerk for Justice Carpinetti on the Alaska Supreme Court. So my wife and I, who I had met doing JVC up here in the early 90s, came back and I worked with Justice Carpinetti for a year as one of his judicial clerks and really relished the opportunity to get back to Juno then.
I love that. And so how did you, when you were a young boy, when you were looking into this, how did it draw you in? What was it about that organization or the work that you were going to be doing? What was that in you? Where did you find that in yourself?
Yeah, what I think I was attracted to is and it's still the principles that run through the organization today are really the four core values of the organization that start with social justice, because we're all in these placements. Simple living, we all receive a very minimal stipend beyond sort of room and board to live on. Spirituality, making sure that in community with each other, we're paying attention to our spiritual lives. And then which of the four did I leave out?
Intentional community.
Yeah, intentional community, which I think in some ways is kind of the most important these days, that you lived in a house, which is sort of relevant to why we're here, with the other volunteers in town. It was 9 for me at the time. It's 5 this year. And in addition to just working together and living together, there was a sense of getting to know people that you might not have necessarily chosen or been drawn to who looked like you or were like you, but really getting intentionally involved in their lives and understanding how those relationships work. So the community is a unique and important part of the JVC experience that I very much appreciated.
I see. And now you have become a board member?
Yes.
And you are listed as well as campaign chair. What does a campaign chair do?
Well, campaign chair on this is revolved around the fact that after 50 years of being in Juno, we finally decided to set down some roots. And even though in a lot of the communities where they serve, the JVC houses end up renting from local owners, we've decided that it makes a lot of sense as an organization for us to purchase a house in Juno. And through the opportunity we had with the previous landlord, of the property the JVs lived here in the West Juno neighborhood over on Douglas Island, we've decided to make the long-term investment in the community by buying that house for the organization, for the volunteers to live in, so they can have that stability, we can have that stability as an organization. But as a nonprofit, it requires us to sort of galvanize sort of support and community and some fundraising so that we can support that effort for a long-term future.
I see. And so what brought you to Juno, the both of you, this time? Was it to sort of get the folks who were volunteering this year set up in the house and kind of introducing them to the community, Greg?
Well, no, it's really about starting to spread the word about this project purchase.
Okay.
Our volunteers have been here for about a month. We have a great local support group that helps get them acclimated to Juno and answer their questions and set up with what they need to live successfully for the year. So we're kind of coming in now that we've embarked on this project to purchase the house and to really galvanize that support that Doug was talking about.
I see. So it's the JV Juno house, which is nice. It'll actually be well, we could call it the J.V. Douglas House, but it's really, yeah. it is Juno. Yes, it is Juno. So that's kind of cool. And people can find out more about this. How would they find out more about donating to this particular thing?
Yeah, great question. So my recommendation would be to go to our website, which is jvcnorthwest.org. And if someone is out there and knows us and is captivated by this idea that we're going to set down roots maybe for another 50 years here as an organization, you know, they could give right away by virtue of that website. And if they're looking to ask me any particular questions, they could email me at info@jvcnorthwest.org.
I love that. Okay, so there's two more things I want to talk about before we run out of time here, which is tell us a few of the organizations that you work with here in Juneau. Where do the volunteers end up, or which organizations do they end up helping?
Great. Yeah. So this year we have our five volunteers at four different agencies in Juneau. Those are Catholic Community Services. Two of them are at SAIL. One is at the Zach Gordon Youth Center, and one is at the Juneau Economic Development Council.
So, I love that.
Yeah, they're doing all kinds of things for them.
I mean, one of the reasons why we thought the investment in Juneau, the long-term investment in Juneau made sense is these placements, as you were referring to before, a lot of these groups are incredibly stable in Juneau, and that doesn't happen in every city. And so in addition to the current placements, Greg talked about whether it's AWARE or, you know, REACH or, you know, JAMI or any of the other organizations we've worked with over the past couple of decades. It's remarkable how consistent those organizations, they've been great partners to us. We like to think we've been great partners to them. And it gives us confidence that 10, 20 years down the road, when this purchase, you know, really starts to pay off for us, that, you know, Juneau will still be a great place for the Jesuit volunteers.
I love that. That's so good. And here's my last question, which is for those who might be living here, we talked about where you're also located. Can people apply to be a volunteer in one of the other states? Let's say they're living here in Juneau and they say, well, I want to be a volunteer. How do I do that? How do I find out more information? I want to go to Montana.
Absolutely. Yeah, we would gladly take their interest in being a volunteer. And they would simply, again, go to our website is the best way. And there is a tab called Apply. And you can find out how to fill out an application and talk to us about what service opportunities are available in what geographic locations.
Is there any age limit or is there any structure on who can apply?
No, we will take anyone above the age of 18.
Okay, great. I love that. That is so cool. Well, and if there's any more information, of course, you can go to jvcnorthwest.org, which is the website, to help out with the Juno House and or learn how to serve as a volunteer and spend a year in a community. It is pretty amazing how often folks who come here for a little bit end up deciding that this might be the place, especially when one of your core values is sort of investing in community, which I think is something that people can really find here in Juneau. So, Greg, Doug, thank you so much for coming in. Gunnath Cheesh, for telling us all about it. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, a unique musical and cinematic project, Refuge Alaska, to celebrate National Public Land Day on September 27th. Plus, the Ice Legacy Project explores the Mendenhall Glacier, and we get the latest from NAMI Juno. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, and have a safe and dry Juno evening.